This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The administration is sticking to the June 30th deadline for the handover of sovereignty in Iraq, but with that date fast approaching, it's still not clear what sovereignty is or to whom it will be given. Committees in both the House and Senate are holding hearings this week to try and learn more about what that transfer of power might look like. With the bloody backdrop of the past few weeks, June 30th is looming as a serious challenge to policymakers in Washington and Baghdad. Tonight on Point, sovereignty in Iraq, what it means to Iraqis and Americans. We begin with the U.N. role in the transfer of power in Iraq. The United States is looking to the United Nations to bring legitimacy to its goal of bringing a democratic government to Iraq. U.N. envoy Lakhdar Brahimi outlined his plan for an interim government to be put in place June 30th. James Bone is the New York correspondent for The Times of London. I asked him how Brahimi's plan differs from the original handover.
It differs in two principal respects. One is that it brought forward elections from when they were originally going to be held. The second is it completely cancels out the regional caucus system that Bremer had planned with the Iraqi Governing Council originally.
Was that caucus system simply so complicated it almost guaranteed that it would be unworkable?
Not really. I think the question is who gets to pick who's in charge and how much the future of Iraq becomes a fait accompli by the time elections are held. That was the issue. If you remember, the circumstances of the UN getting re-engaged in Iraq were that Ayatollah Ali Sistani, the Shia leader, objected to Bremer's plan. He basically objected because he felt that the Shia, as the majority in Iraq, risked being disenfranchised again because the cards would be stacked against them by the interim arrangements, and particularly by the regional caucus system, where the coalition was going to put together a series of caucuses across the country to choose through some kind of indirect elections an interim government that would have ruled until late 2005.
And why is it, do you think, that Brahimi was able to come up with a plan that the Grand Ayatollah Sistani hasn't endorsed necessarily but hasn't scuttled, unlike Bremer's plan?
Well, if you remember, Ayatollah Sistani originally wanted elections not in late 2005, as Mr. Bremer had suggested, but before the handover of power on June 30th, so that the coalition would be handing power to a properly elected Iraqi government, and one, no doubt, with a Shia majority. Mr. Brahimi came in and said, well, we can't do the elections by June 30th, but we can do them sooner than the end of next year. And what is more, yes, I will agree to Ayatollah Sistani's demand between the handover of power and elections, the interim government will have very circumscribed powers, so they won't be able to cook the system so that it's stacked against you when there are elections held.
And what happens to the Iraqi Governing Council under this plan?
Under this plan, the Iraqi Governing Council disappears at midnight on June 30th. That was another thing that Ayatollah Sistani wanted. He didn't want some of the exiles who have been put onto that handpicked council to have an artificially prolonged political life. That's something that Mr. Brahimi sided with him on. So at a certain point in recent months, it seemed that the Governing Council was going to try and extend its existence, but that hasn't happened in the end.
And the Brahimi plan also calls for a consultative assembly, somewhat along the lines of the Loya Jirga in Afghanistan. Help us understand what that is exactly and how it would work in Iraq.
Well, I think the thing to understand about the Brahimi plan is that there are really two competing pressures. Mr. Brahimi basically wanted to have a technocratic government of purely functionaries taking the country to elections and basically sees the landmark as the January elections. But there are a lot of existing constituencies in Iraq, particularly the sectarian and ethnic-based parties that had a role in the opposition and have had a role in the Iraqi Governing Council, and they don't want their role just to disappear when the Iraqi Governing Council goes poof on midnight on the June 30th. So what Mr. Brahimi has had to do is work out parallel structures for this purely technocratic government. One of the structures is a national conference, which will then elect what he calls a consultative assembly. There are two things significant about the way he's done that. Many people wanted the national conference to pick the ministers who will run the country, the prime minister, the health minister, the oil minister, those kind of people. Mr. Brahimi has specifically divorced those two functions. The ministers will be picked by the UN in consultation with the coalition, the Iraqi Governing Council, and Iraqi trade unions, professional groups, universities, etc. And the national conference will have no role in picking the technocratic government, because Mr. Brahimi didn't want politics to intrude on that function. He thought everyone would start fighting over which portfolios their people would get. The second thing is the national conference will elect a consultative assembly, but it's very tellingly called a consultative assembly. The politicians wanted it to be a legislative assembly so that they could go on making laws until elections were held. Mr. Brahimi, again taking Ayatollah Ali Sistani's line on this, didn't want the politicians to have a role in making laws and presenting a fait accompli before elections. And therefore, this consultative assembly will only really be a talking shop.
And we also know that Brahimi was only able to work around Baghdad. He wasn't able to travel to many cities outside the capital because of security problems there. So do we really have a sense yet of how this plan might be viewed elsewhere, particularly among the Kurds in the north and the Shia to the south?
Well, he did go to Mosul. He went by helicopter. As he was coming back from Mosul, Baghdad became too dangerous to land. He had to fly all the way to Kuwait. He spent the night in Kuwait, and then he flew back to Baghdad. That wasn't made public in his trip, but I know that's something that happened. So it gives you some idea of the circumstances he's working under. He has said he will go back to the Kurdish area. I don't think that the Kurds are the most difficult constituency for him. I mean, the two key constituencies in the UN eyes are the radical Shia and even Ali Sistani's people who have stayed out, or Ali Sistani has stayed out from the governing council and stayed away from meeting Americans. He has met Mr. Brahimi, and he did meet Sergio Vieira de Mello, the previous UN envoy, but on this last trip that Mr. Brahimi made, he tellingly did not meet Mr. Brahimi. And secondly, of course, what are called the Sunni Arab nationalists, or the former Baathists, the hardliners from the Sunni Arab side. Those are the key constituencies. And you can see that in what he's done, Mr. Brahimi is trying to court those two constituencies. One is he spoke out against de-Baathification, the policy of the coalition, suggesting that some of the ministers might be people who had been Ba'ath Party members, but who were only, let's say, nominally Ba'ath Party members and were admired technocrats for their professional skills. And then I've explained why, in several other respects, the bringing forward of elections, for instance, and the constraints on the powers of the interim government, he's courting Ali Sistani's followers.
Bottom line, does this seem to be a plan that can work?
Well, I think that it might postpone the showdown at least until elections are held, and then there is a big question about whether elections will be possible in the time frame laid out. I mean, the way it's meant to work at the moment, there's meant to be an electoral commission and legal arrangements for the registration of voters and the registration of parties by May next month, in order for there to be an eight-month lead time to elections. A lot of Arab ambassadors I've spoken to at the UN are increasingly sceptical that the timetable for elections will be held. The other question is, who becomes prime minister? I mean, it might be true that the health minister is somebody uncontroversial, that everybody in the Iraq hospital system knows who the best four or five qualified health bureaucrats are. But it's not necessarily true that it will be as easy to pick a prime minister. So there'll be a big dispute about who the person the prime minister is, and a lot will depend on the character of that prime minister.
James Bone, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
James Bone is New York correspondent for The Times of London. He spoke with me from New York. We're talking this hour about what sovereignty means in Iraq and to whom it will go when the U.S. hands it over. In addition to the U.N., Congress is trying to tackle the problem this week with hearings before committees in both the House and Senate. This hour on Point, sovereignty in Iraq, what that means for Iraqis and Americans. Do you see June 30th as a meaningless deadline or a symbol of real progress? What do you expect sovereignty for Iraqis to entail? And what does the Bush administration, the U.S. military, and the United Nations have to do to meet the deadline and to make it matter? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is Stephen Walt, academic dean and professor of international affairs at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Welcome, Steve.
Very nice to be here.
Pleasure having you. Let's start by dissecting this word a little bit, the concept of sovereignty. Where does that come from?
Historically, sovereignty is a legal concept referring to governments being essentially immune from foreign interference. When a king was sovereign within his own realm, it meant that outsiders were not supposed to interfere on his territory. Similarly, when a government is considered sovereign within their own territory today, we think of them as not being completely free to do whatever they want. For example, governments aren't supposed to violate human rights, even though it's a purely internal matter, but it generally means that they are free from foreign interference and free from foreign control. So when we think of turning sovereignty over to the Iraqis, we're, at least in terms of common usage, referring to giving the Iraqis back their country where they will determine their own political fate.
And what's the moral obligation here as we look toward this transfer of sovereignty? I mean, one of the catchphrases we're hearing is, if you broke it, you fix it. So is there a moral obligation as well as a legal one here?
Well, I think one thing to remember about June 30th, and in fact the administration and a number of its spokesmen are starting to concede this point, is that we're not going to have the restoration of a fully independent Iraqi political authority at that point. The fact that the Brahimi arrangements refer to individuals that will be picked by the United States and Great Britain and the United Nations suggests that the initial set of officials that are essentially being handed authority in some sense on June 30th are not going to have complete independent authority. They're not going to be able to, for example, tell the U.S. Army what to do. So we're, I think, in the most optimistic scenario, seeing the beginnings of a gradual transition that might eventually lead to the restoration of fully effective sovereignty. But that's not going to happen suddenly at midnight.
You were writing before the war about what you thought might happen post-war. Has that pretty much played out the way you anticipated?
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, those of us who were very skeptical about this war in the first place were never worried that the United States would not win militarily. The Iraqi army under Saddam Hussein was never a serious obstacle for the American military. The question was what you did after you had thrown him out of power. And as you know, the phrase you already mentioned, that you know, once you break it, you bought it. I think what we've seen over the past year is precisely what most of us feared, that we didn't have a plan, that it was going to be quite an intractable problem to figure out how you restore an effective government there, and not just restoring electricity, not just restoring water, but also rebuilding political institutions that were dismantled under Saddam Hussein and where there were deep, deep fissures within Iraqi society. It has not helped that the United States has proceeded to sort of improvise its way along and, in retrospect, done a variety of things that have probably made the problem worse.
Has anything happened that you did not anticipate?
None of us, I think, understood all of the fine details. There are some things that didn't occur. We now know we didn't find the weapons of mass destruction that people had said we were going to find there. We have not seen the outbreak of civil war, which some people predicted in the first few weeks or months. I think the potential for civil war is still there. Right now, there are, of course, over 100,000 American troops and a variety of other coalition forces there, which are, to some extent, keeping the lid on, but we still don't know what will happen going forward. And unfortunately, the Brahimi plan, although it's probably progress in some senses, doesn't have any guarantees attached to it either. It is the latest in a series of improvisations.
And in a few words, before we take a break, do you think that the world will look very different in Iraq from June 30th to July 1st?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think you can't really call the Brahimi plan a plan. It is more of a sketch, and it's to his credit that he was able to make some progress on this. But it is essentially a rough outline of a process. But just to note, the most obvious thing that's missing is we don't know any of the personnel that are going to be handed authority at this point. Presumably, when we chose the Iraqi Iraqi Governing Council over a year ago, we were trying to pick people who would be successful and have some legitimacy within Iraq. The question is now, can we find a new set of people that are likely to do better than the Governing Council did?
All right, we'll continue our discussion in just a moment. We're talking this hour about the June 30th deadline in Iraq. What do the Bush administration and the UN have to do to make it work? And what do you expect sovereignty for Iraqis to look like? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the June 30th transfer of sovereignty to the Iraqis. How important do you think it is to have some indication of progress there? Who does the deadline benefit more, the American public or Iraqis? And do you expect Iraq to look different after June 30th? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Stephen Walt, academic dean and professor of foreign affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And I also want to bring in Marina Ottaway, who's joining us from Washington. She's a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and also co-author of a policy brief, The Right Road to Sovereignty in Iraq. Marina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And tell us, what does the Marina plan look like?
I think it is too late to adopt the kind of plan that we had suggested. Our idea was that it was important to have an elected government as soon as possible, but it was also important to avoid the problems that sometimes you run into with early elections. And therefore, we had suggested the two-tier system of election, one held probably about this time. You have to remember that our proposal came much earlier. And the second one, after a new constitution had been adopted and there had been adequate time to organize. I think it's far too late in the game now to try and go back to a plan of that sort. Events have progressed too fast. And I totally agree with Brahimi's conclusion that it would take at least 8 months to organize an election, and therefore it's far too late now.
Stephen, what about that, about the timing of the elections? And also, is this primarily a date to make Americans feel better, to feel as if there's progress being made, as we spoke of a moment ago, or is this something to make the Iraqis feel that change is truly happening there?
I'm not sure it's either one, to be fair. This is, as I suggested before, an attempt to sort of improvise our way towards a solution where no one has a clear idea of exactly how we'll get there. I mean, this is like the old joke when you're asked for directions and you say, well, you know, if I were you, I wouldn't try to get there from here. There are sort of two fundamental problems that are going to face any plan, whether it's Brahimi's or one that we might put together if the Brahimi plan doesn't work out. First of all, one has to devise a political formula that the various constituent groups within Iraq are willing to live with. And that anything you do right now that tacks in favor of one or the other is likely to bother the one that's not getting what they wanted. So if we have now leaned more closely to Sistani and to the Shia, the question is what is that going to do to the primarily Sunni-based insurgency in other parts of the country? If we tack too far to try and make the Sunnis happy in a post-Saddam Iraq, then we have the concerns that the Shia feel that they're being denied the political control or at least the predominant political influence they've come to expect. And where that really hits the road is the question of who's going to command the army and command the security forces. In Saddam's Iraq, those forces were predominantly controlled by the Sunnis. The Sunnis have the military expertise. The Sunnis are the ones that have been causing us the most trouble in terms of insurgents. And so if you're devising a political formula, that ultimately also has to devise a set of security institutions that will both be effective in the field and that all Iraqis are going to see as legitimate. And we have no answers. I certainly don't have an answer for how to do that, but neither does anybody else.
Well, let's see if Marina might have one. And specifically, Marina, do you see any of this as working without the Sunnis, who were accustomed to power under Saddam? Are they likely to buy into this?
The problem is that there is nobody who can buy into the Brahimi plan for the Sunnis. It is conceivable that if Sistani agrees to go along with this plan, as long as he can have elections, early next year, then the Shia will be willing to give it a try. It is certainly conceivable that the Kurds will give it a try. They have received considerable concessions in the interim constitution. The problem is that there is nobody speaking for the Sunnis at this point. In other words, it is difficult to think about who is there among the Sunnis who could say, well, we'll accept this plan because there is nothing better at this point, and receive some acceptance on the part of the rest of the Sunni community. There is the Shura Council, this council of Sunni clerics that was formed a few months ago, that is trying to establish itself in that role of speaking for the Sunnis. But it's still very, very uncertain how much authority it really is and how many people are willing to listen to it.
1-800-423-8255, if you'd like to join the conversation. We're going to Kevin now, who's on the line from Fall River, Massachusetts. Hello, Kevin.
Hello. Yes. The concept of sovereignty is really elastic. I mean, in Guantanamo, the sovereign power is Cuba. I mean, so the whole idea that it can be emptied of all contents in extreme instances. And, of course, the United States arrogates it to itself the ability to launch preemptive wars against international law and the United Nations to overthrow the sovereign government of Iraq. And what I mean by that, so it's a very pliable, elastic concept. And I'm wondering the limitations. We talk about the possible problems of balancing out the various ethnic religious groups in Iraq and how we can get them to work together, but it seems to be a presumption that this war had nothing to do with American interest except letting the Iraqis be liberated and free themselves and have democracy. And I'm wondering, what are the parameters that the United States is going to impose as the minimal conditions that would restrict Iraqi sovereignty? Would it be, we wouldn't allow them to elect Hussein and reestablish him as a dictator. I mean, that's, an outrageous example. But how about American military presence? I mean, the neoconservatives wanted Iraq to be a launching point for some kind of bandwagon that would call into question the regimes in Iran and Syria and be an ally to Israel. I'm wondering, when it comes to American military bases, oil interests, and so forth, are there any requirements that we're going to, we in the sense of the administrations, are going to require of the Iraqis as untouchable?
Okay, Kevin, thanks for the call. We'll put that question to Stephen Walt, first of all. And also, it is a very interesting point. If the U.S. is still in control of the military and the purse strings and the resources, what does a transfer of power really mean?
I think the two words you want to keep in mind here is fig leaf. In terms of June 30th, right, the United States will still be very much in control of Iraq, or at least in as much control as it is today. We will have over 100,000 troops there. There's no talk of a precipitous decline in the American presence there. The United States is currently planning an embassy which will have somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 people assigned to it. That is a very large presence in a country. I think that may be the largest embassy in American history. We are principally responsible for the reconstruction, and we're financing the reconstruction. So the idea that we are going to establish a prime minister and a head of state and some vice presidents and some governing councils and Iraqis will see us as suddenly not having a major role in the country, I think, is not correct. This then raises the point that the caller, I think, had his finger on, which is that it's very difficult for any government anywhere to establish itself as a legitimate sovereign authority if it's not able to act independently in at least some ways. So the sort of paradox we face is in order for an Iraqi government to demonstrate its authority, demonstrate its legitimacy, it actually has to disagree with us about something and be able to make that disagreement stick. If every time there's a disagreement between what the new Iraqi government thinks its interests are and what we might think our interests are, and if they cave, that doesn't look like an independent government, and that doesn't look like a government that many Iraqis are going to support either.
And Marina, how do you see that playing out? It's an interesting point. Do the Iraqis have to push back in a significant way so that they don't look like puppets?
Well, some Iraqis certainly will push back. I mean, the Sistani has already started pushing back in his objections to the parts of the interim constitution. The Kurds have started pushing back by asking for certain guarantees of local autonomy and so on. The Bush administration is a real bind because it's beginning to talk more and more about a symbolic transfer of sovereignty. But that is not enough because that does not do what the U.S. needs this transfer to do from this point of view, that is to convince Americans that things in the Iraq are going better and to convince Iraqi as well that things are going better and they are getting back in control of their country. On the other hand, the U.S. cannot really turn over control to an Iraqi government because there is no Iraqi government that can hold the country together from the point of view of security right now. So that makes it impossible for the U.S. to give much more power to an Iraqi government. And thirdly, and I think this is something which has been neglected, the U.S. cannot have even the legal fiction of a return to sovereignty, because if the U.S. tries to promote the interim government as an internationally recognized government that legally has sovereignty in the country, then the Security Council Resolution 1511, which is the one that gives some sort of legal justification to the U.S. presence there, expires. And then the U.S. finds itself in Iraq without really any cover whatsoever under international law. So even for the United States, even deciding how much it wants to give back or how much it wants to pretend to give back, it's a very, very difficult issue at this point.
1-800-423-8255 is our number if you'd like to join us. To Ann Arbor, Michigan now. Scott's on the line. Hello, Scott.
Hello. I just have a question regarding the recent escalation of violence and the loss of coalition partners recently. My question is, should these two negative or unfortunate circumstances continue to go in the same direction? If we continue to lose coalition partners and might continue to have the high level of violence that we've been seeing in the last few weeks, does it look like we're going to be able to continue with our policy of insisting on setting up a democracy there by July or June 30th, or will we possibly have to change in some way?
So, Scott, you're suggesting maybe move the deadline back?
Well, Kerry has said, he's suggesting that there may be some alternative form of government that would be more suitable than democracy there, more realistic perhaps. And also, I think that's probably the biggest question I have. And also, I guess the question of moving it back. I mean, if the violence is still at the same level as it is today, on June 30th, will it be even feasible to hand over the sovereignty in the middle of a civil war?
Okay, Scott, thanks so much for the call. And it is an interesting question, particularly that overarching issue about whether democracy is really what the U.S. wants in Iraq, Stephen Walt, because if it turns out that means a strongly anti-American, democratically elected government, in some ways you could argue that U.S. interests were better off under Saddam, who presided over a weakened Iraq, and especially now that we know he did not have weapons of mass destruction.
Well, I don't think anyone's going to argue that we were better off with Saddam Hussein in power, although it's worth noting that, for example, Iraq, contrary to what we were told before the war, was not a hotbed of international terrorism. It wasn't a place that al-Qaeda or related groups were flocking because it gave them an opportunity to mobilize. Saddam Hussein had many flaws, but he tried to run a fairly tight ship inside, and he had no love lost for bin Laden and al-Qaeda. I think the caller raised a couple of very good points. I mean, the recent events in April, violence in Fallujah and elsewhere, is mostly disturbing, in part because it shows that resistance to the American presence there appears to be getting more broadly based. It is not simply a bunch of hangers-on from the regime. That's not surprising because foreign occupation tends to generate a lot of friction with the local population, and the longer you stay, the more people would like to see you leave. And I think it's also true in retrospect that we've done a number of things that weren't ideal. They were good for protecting American forces, but it meant we were acting in a more heavy-handed way towards the local population. The second, I think, even more disturbing thing is the performance of the Iraqi security forces, the various groups, police and others, that we'd been trying to put together. So we actually had some Iraqis we could hand the security problem over to when it was time for the Americans to leave. And the fact is, you know, in a variety of contexts, they either melted away. In some cases, they appear to have participated in ambushes. And even the most optimistic reading of this, it's hard to not to sort of say we're back to square one. In fact, we've brought in General David Petraeus, who's a terrific American officer, to try and do a better job. But it again suggests that a year into the process, we're still trying to find ways to put this together. Just one final point. The other thing we have to worry about going forward, and it gets to this question of sovereignty again, is to what extent are other countries going to be interfering here as well? Whether or not the Iranians are going to be in a rather quiet way trying to influence the political evolution there. What's the relationship between Turkey and the Kurds? When you have a weak or non-existent local government, it's an inevitable temptation for others to interfere. And I think we're likely to see that. We've already gotten some signs of it. As the American role diminishes and as we try to turn things over to the Iraqis, we ought to expect more foreign interference, albeit at a low level, throughout the country. And that's not something that's going to be easy for us to stop or control.
Marina, we're going to have to say goodbye to you in a few moments. So I wonder if you just go back to the policy brief for a moment that you were the co-author of, The Right Road to Sovereignty in Iraq, and whether there were points there that still are useful, that are perhaps being overlooked in all of this argument, if you had to pick one or two.
Yes, I would pick 2 points. First of all, one, that the importance of having a transition in stages. That is, that you need an interim government, and then after the formation of an interim government, which has a degree of credibility, you need a long period to allow discussion, to allow consensus building, to allow coalitions to be formed. One, if we look beyond June 30th transition, but we look at what is going to happen according in the plan that exists now after the elections of early 2005. The plan tries to rush through the final stage of the transition. The plan at this point calls for elections in early 2005, followed by the writing of a permanent constitution in a space of a few months. 2 months for discussing this permanent constitution with the public, a referendum on the constitution, and then elections for the parliament, essentially, by the end of that year. So what the plan is trying to do at this point is to compress a very complicated process in a period of just a few months, of barely a year. And I think this is not going to help at all. It will make all of these steps purely symbolic. It means that the constitution is going to be adopted, the permanent constitution will end up by being adopted pretty much like the interim constitution, without a real debate in the country and so on. So
Marina, we'll have to say goodbye to you there. We thank you so much. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about sovereignty in Iraq and what that means for Iraqis and Americans. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Stephen Walt, academic dean and professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He laid out the arguments against going to war in a foreign affairs piece entitled Unnecessary War. And now here we are talking about the consequences of that war, Steve Walt. And I want to pick up on something that we briefly touched on before we took a break about Brahimi and his credibility. Does he have any credibility among Iraqis? We know that he's the former foreign minister of Algeria. But how do Iraqis view him? And also, what about the UN's credibility these days? Because there has been some questions raised about the Oil for Food program, for example.
I don't think the Oil for Food program is a problem for the UN in Iraq. It may be a problem in terms of how the UN is viewed in the United States. Brahimi is, you know, by all reports, a very savvy, very experienced, very patient man who I think has a clear sense of what can and cannot be done. And I think if you look carefully at his statements, they're somewhat refreshing for the rather sober realism with which he's been reporting back. He's not giving us a romantic image of what's coming forward. He's trying to be upbeat but not being unrealistic about it. So in terms of his performance, I think, you know, it's all one might expect. The degree to which he has any sort of standing or authority in Iraq is very difficult to say because the game that all of the different factions and groups are playing, of course, is to try and have their own interests represented in whatever solution he comes up with. And in some respects, try to, you know, put their own markers down and persuade him to support them. I think it's very hard to say, therefore, sort of what kind of personal authority he brings. That gets to the question of the United Nations. The United Nations is not a magic solution to this. The United Nations doesn't have security forces of sufficient size that it can dispatch. The United Nations doesn't have a magic wand that it can wave, and it's why the United Nations has been reluctant to take this responsibility on all along. There is also the concern in some parts of the Iraqi population that the United Nations is in some sense just a lackey for a set of Western powers, most notably the United States, and therefore it has actually relatively little credibility. My bottom line, I guess, on this is that everyone there will try to use Brahimi and the United Nations process to get their own interests or get their own positions enhanced. If they find that the process is leaving them in worse shape, then they'll start to defect from it.
All right, let's go to Dick now. He's on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. Hello, Dick.
Hi. I just want to make the point that this new prime minister might be a more powerful figure than people think, just by virtue of making public statements. For instance, what if he were to say that the U.S. troops should stay out of the Iraqi cities? You know, in the court of world public opinion, I don't see how the U.S., at declaring this a sovereign government, would have any choice but to abide. And I'd also like to make the point, I think this is actually could be a healthy situation. I think the Iraqi Civil Defense Force may be more effective and enthusiastic if it was put under the chain of command of an Iraqi civil government.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dick. What about that?
Maybe, but events of the past year don't make me all that optimistic about that. If you recall what happened after the American invasion, right, we didn't bring enough forces. We in particular didn't bring enough sort of police and civil administration forces early on. So what you had instead was sort of widespread looting throughout Iraq, exactly what you might have expected. It seems to me if the United States withdrew from a whole series of the contested areas, what you would be more likely to see is a repeat of what happened the last time we removed all of the security forces from Iraq. I mean, I think there's something to be said for the argument that Iraqis may eventually fight harder or be more cohesive under their own command than if they are being led around by the United States. But we have a long way to go to create the kinds of security institutions. One of the things that's they could do that. Now, one of the things that's compounded that, of course, is that we basically let the entire Iraqi army go, and we've conducted a pretty thoroughgoing de-bathification process. Unfortunately, what that did was remove from any positions of influence anybody who actually knew how to run the country. And not all of those people were sort of diehard Saddam loyalists. And it's going to be a process of trying to bring some of those people back, it seems to me, that we're going to have to conduct in the future.
And so what do you see as the headlines on July 1st? Are they going to say smooth handover or civil war breaks out?
Neither one. I think there's going to be a variety of people, some saying glass half full and falling, some saying glass half full and rising, others saying glass half empty. But the real answer is not going to be determined on June 30th. It'll be in the weeks after that.
All right. Steve Wall, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Stephen is academic dean and professor of international affairs at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Earlier this hour, we heard from Marina Ottaway, who is co-author of a policy brief, The Right Road to Sovereignty in Iraq. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In just a moment, On Point's audio archaeologist digs up the story of an American who became an integral part of the Nazi propaganda machine during World War II. This is On Point. For almost as long as there has been radio, there has been radio propaganda. Even just last year, the United States pumped anti-Saddam propaganda into Iraq from transmitters on aircraft during the early days of the war there. And in the years leading up to World War II, the Nazis in Germany mastered the use of shortwave radio to influence public opinion elsewhere. One of their most influential broadcasters of propaganda was a German-American named Fred Kaltenbach. On Point audio archaeologist Ned Connors digs up sounds and stories from the past for our program. Tonight he brings us the story of Fred Kaltenbach and the World War II Nazi propaganda machine.
Germany calling, Germany calling, Germany calling.
Long before the German invasion of Poland in September 1939, the official start of World War II, a new type of war raged in the Earth's magnetic field, thanks to the new technology of shortwave radio. International broadcasting is almost as old as broadcast radio itself. By the mid-1920s, experimenters had discovered that high-frequency or short radio waves could be bounced off the ionosphere and directed to specific areas of the planet. Infant radio had gone global.
Here are the Reich Sender Ambush, Station Bremen, and Station DXB on the 31-meter band. You are about to hear our news in English.
The British Ministry of Misinformation has been conducting a systematic campaign of frightening British women and girls about the danger of being injured by splinters from German bombs.
The Nazis quickly recognized the propaganda potential of shortwave radio. During his years in prison, Hitler commented on the psychological power of radio in Mein Kampf. He said, "The more modest its intellectual ballast, the more exclusively it takes into consideration the emotions of the masses, the more effective it will be." By the mid-1930s, multiband radios could be found in parlors across America, and searching the dial for international shortwave broadcasts was something of a craze. The psychological role that these broadcasts were playing in the European conflict and the propaganda battle for American public opinion were also drawing attention. From December 1939 to July 1941, a small house on a side street of Princeton, New Jersey, served as America's radio ear to the world. During its 20 months of operation, the privately funded Princeton Listening Center recorded and transcribed thousands of hours of international propaganda broadcasts. While monitoring English-language Nazi broadcasts from Berlin, one voice stood out among the clipped, European-accented broadcasters.
This is Fred W. Kaltenbach bringing you another military review of the week. Reliable reports coming to us from Lisbon indicate that Europe's most productive shipbuilding yard, that of Harland & Wolff Shipbuilding Company in Belfast, has been completely destroyed in the German air attacks on that city in the opening days of April. German Air Force has thereby shown that it is able to strike and cripple every shipbuilding yard in the British Isles. It is no wonder, therefore, that Englishmen view their overseas supply problem with the greatest pessimism, and make those piteous appeals to America for ships.
It was the flat Midwest accent of Fred Kaltenbach, born in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of German immigrants. After honorable service in the First World War, Kaltenbach came to embrace a romantic, mystical form of German nationalism and espoused National Socialism even before the Hitler regime had come to power. A Dubuque High School history teacher, he was fired in the first year of the Reich for trying to organize a Hitler youth group at his school. A few years later, he moved to Germany to begin doctoral work. By 1939, Kaltenbach had married one of Hermann Göring's secretaries and found work with the German Overseas Service as a shortwave commentator for English language broadcasts beamed to North America. Over time, British listeners struck by his rural American accent nicknamed Kaltenbach Lord Hee-Haw. He didn't mind. He even introduced himself that way.
Merry Lord Hee-Haw with his little dear Harry on the air.
Throughout the war, Kaltenbach wore a number of propaganda hats at the Overseas Radio Service. One of them was a weekly review of war news. The consistent message? A German victory was inevitable, and the Americans, still uninvolved militarily, needed to stay out of European affairs. While the military news may have been on the dry side, Kaltenbach's boss, propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, well understood Hitler's admonition to keep it lowbrow.
Dear Harry, this is England's Lord Hee-Haw speaking to you and the folks back home in Iowa from Berlin.
Another propaganda device was a source of some embarrassment to Harry Hageman, an old schoolmate of Kaltenbach back in Iowa. Throughout much of the war, Kaltenbach broadcast a weekly Letter to Harry. This broadcast, recorded at Princeton in May of 1940, was a thinly disguised appeal to keep America out of the war and at odds with Britain.
President Roosevelt's preparedness speech on Thursday, in which he requested from Congress vast sums for military purposes, has met with general approval in Germany. Both the German people, who have the kindliest of feelings for the people of the United States, and official Germany, which has the greatest respect for the Monroe Doctrine, are sympathetic to America's aim to keep the war far distant from our shores. A strong American Navy will further silence the tongues of those circles in the United States who are playing England's game by maintaining that the British Navy is Uncle Sam's first line of defense.
The Nazis held out a hope that millions of German Americans, like Kaltenbach, would remain loyal to the Reich and would resist any American move against the fatherland. Kaltenbach drove this point home with a maudlin 1940 broadcast commemorating his immigrant father on the first anniversary of his death.
A year ago today, one of the finest men who ever lived died on an Iowa farm in the vicinity of Waterloo. He came to America in his youth, a poor immigrant from Germany. He worked hard, saved, and opened up a business of his own. Then in 1917, he was deeply grieved to see the land of his adoption, his beloved United States, swept into the maelstrom of war against Germany. It was as if his best girl had turned against his mother. Perhaps it was the Lord's will that he should be taken home when he was, to spare him the pain of seeing the land of his birth again vilified and calumniated in the American press. It would have been more than he could bear to see an irresponsible journalism pour out its vials of hate upon a land which had sent so many millions of its sons to America and which has only the kindliest of feelings for the people of the United States. Thank God, none of this hate can touch him now.
Kaltenbach remained with the Overseas Service until the very end. He was arrested in the spring of 1945 as the Soviet and American troops marched on Berlin. This corn-fed American propagandist for Hitler died in a Soviet prison camp the following October. Germany surrendered officially on May 7th. A number of Fred Kaltenbach's radio colleagues in the North American service were captured, tried, and convicted in American courts. With no small thanks to the evidence gathered by the Princeton Listening Center in the months before Pearl Harbor. With the fall of Berlin, Hitler's elaborate propaganda machine, its American hirelings, and its modest intellectual ballast were silenced.
Germany calling, Germany calling, Germany calling.
Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.